This is Jamie Shern Cohen. I'm here with Sarah Faulkner at her office on Green Street. Today is June 21st, 2018, and I'm interviewing Sarah as part of the Oral History Summer School Archive Project. Sarah, can I ask you to introduce yourself?
My name is Sarah Faulkner. It's up to me what I say, isn't it? I've studied a little oral history myself, but it's funny how when we introduce ourselves, there's so many layers and ways that we can do that. And especially under capitalism, you know, there's this kind of tendency to give this pithy sort of, these are my achievements and this is why you should be interested in me. So I know that I'm being recorded for a regional archive, so I would like to say that my relationship to Hudson, I've been living in Hudson since 2009. I'm semi-nomadic, so I go back and forth to other locations, but I feel very connected to this community since 2009.
Great, thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about where we are?
We are in my Hudson office, which is also a space that I make available to colleagues and comrades for other projects. So sometimes you might, if you live in Hudson, you might be here, and I might not be here, you might be with someone else or another group of people. I've been at this location for a couple of years. I'm a New York State licensed massage therapist, and I've also trained in other modalities. So I practice body work and healing arts relating to primarily these days traditional Tibetan medicine and other areas kind of within my general purview, which is pretty eclectic.
And how did you get here?
Into this space? Or into Hudson, or this planet. This planet. How did I get to this planet? Sometimes I ask that. So I'm also an artist and a writer. And like probably everyone listening to this recording, living under capitalism and have always tried to figure out how to earn a living and be in line with my values and make the world a better place. So though I'm an artist and writer, it's equally important to me to really be of service. And so I'm really fortunate that I also really enjoy body work and offering healing art services. So I suppose one of the reasons that I stay in the Hudson community is there's so many other folks living here and around here who are also, like me, interested in contributing to community and being part of a community. So that is to say, as regards like healing arts, it's not just, oh, here's this thing I do to earn a living. When you practice a healing art, it's a little bigger than a commercial transaction. So yes, I do quantify some of the things I do, and I charge fees for those that feel sustainable to me and sustainable to the people receiving the services. But it's also really, especially in traditional Tibetan medicine, which I study, it's not a capitalist paradigm. And practicing Buddhists, for example, are, you know, we want to benefit all sentient beings. That doesn't fit so neatly into, well, I'm here between 9 to 5 and this is my fee. You know, in other words, I'm really flexible about fees and availability, and I really do try to be of service. So also in terms of practicing within this community, I feel like I have colleagues and comrades that I can also network with, and together we help other people and each other. So that's a big part of why I'm specifically here in Hudson to do a lot of my work.
Would you mind talking a little bit about maybe since 2009, just the development or your integration into that community of healers and
folks? So some of the, when I moved to Hudson, I immediately, well, I think while I was still in Brooklyn, I met my radio show co-host, Lauren Chambroni, currently of Good Fight Herb Co., and we were in a collective that originated in Brooklyn, the Rock Dove Collective, which was founded by some folks that are, everyone's kind of dispersed from Brooklyn now, but the goal was to have a network of providers who were social justice oriented, inclusive, people, harm reductionist minded, queer friendly. Sorry about that noise. I think, well, there's someone, if you hear that noise, that's someone opening a garage door. It's nothing to be worried about. And so we had met kind of on the internet, Lauren and I, and then when we met in person, it just so happened we were both moving up to Hudson. So it was a very auspicious kind of great start to making community up here. So we got involved in a collective up here in Hudson as well, that for a while had a physical space. I was also really involved with, there had been a community garden for about 20 years that had been on some plots of land where 20 years ago or more now, some buildings had burned down and local residents had reclaimed the space and founded an organic garden. And I was involved with that for a while. And then two things happened that really shaped my experience in 2013. The community garden, a city agency decided to sell the land for the community garden. And I didn't realize it, but at that time I was getting really sick with Lyme disease. So it was a very difficult year for me. It was also, I felt very vulnerable and exposed in many ways. And for example, one day I walked down Warren Street and saw the picture on the front page of the paper was me in the courthouse, like, you know, because we had to go to City Hall and speak about the community garden and why it was important to try to save it. And so that was a very emotional and difficult time for me, and we lost the community garden, and there were some very sad and disappointing reasons why we lost, not the least of which is a city agency that was involved in that has also subsequently been involved with a controversial $10 million grant that was written that I think many people in Hudson are now aware of. There were some problems in terms of personal and political, government and private boundaries being crossed and manipulated. Maybe that's all I'll say about that for now. So anyway, so it felt, you know, kind of at the time I really was feeling like this little micro ecosystem was being colonized, and then at the time my physical body was being colonized by this organism, and then I got very, very physically sick. So I had to really change how I was on every level, not just, I had previously been really active in the community and working a lot and being social, and then I kind of went into this insular little world and worked as much as I could, but other than that was kind of hyper introvert and lots of time off for a while. And that really, and then in the meantime, so then my healing process, the worst of it, took maybe 2 years. And then during that time, there were continued changes to the cityscape of Hudson, and Hudson has changed a lot since I've been here too.
Okay. Do you want to talk a little bit about your life before Hudson?
Before Hudson, let's see. So I had a kind of a, I grew up after a few moves when I was very young. I would say much of my growing up years were spent in a Midwestern college town, Bloomington, Indiana, which at the time I did not realize was actually very progressive and diverse. And when I moved to New York City at the age of 20, I was a little disappointed Bloomington, Indiana, while I was growing up there, had international students from all over the world. When I was very young, there was a top-of-the-line particle accelerator, so there were a lot of graduate students from Asia and Africa and Europe doing graduate research with their family. So I grew up in a very international, it was public school, but we had a lot of international students, and a lot of my fellow Americans actually thought I was foreign, which is kind of interesting and says a lot. And then I moved to New York City when I was 20, and I pretty much lived in different neighborhoods in Brooklyn until 2007. I lived in Ireland that for about a little over a year, and then came back to the States. During the time I lived in New York City, I went from, that was where I started on my second career, which is massage therapy. I went back to school to become a licensed massage therapist. My undergraduate work was in the visual arts, and I worked for a time in the art world, but did not find that personally very fulfilling. And there are specific people that were magnetic and instrumental in as reasons for me moving places also.
Do you want to talk about any of those people?
No. One thing that's been interesting to me living in Hudson compared to my life practicing while I was in a big city in Brooklyn, I mean, I think folks maybe are more used to this with psychotherapy, but it's really true of any healthcare provider. It's really healthy if there's some kind of protective boundary around your provider and you, so that, I mean, whenever we receive care from someone, sometimes if we're receiving care and if we know a lot about that person's personal life, then it's maybe not in our best interest. We might worry about them. We might have a judgment about them. We might form ideas why we should take care of them or why their care is not good for us. Or these are just some ideas I'm thinking of. I'm sure people can think of many other reasons. But in other words, there's a lot of good reasons to have some distance. In my training, we were taught that unlike psychotherapy, it's not necessarily, it's certainly not forbidden in our sort of the oaths we swear when we get our license and everything. It's, we could legally be friends with our patients if we choose to, but it's, we're always advised to have a policy and to really think about that and to also still have boundaries around that. So all of that is to say that in Brooklyn, most often, you know, people, I enjoy clients very much and they feel like friends, but while they're on the table, I'm always very aware that their needs come first. It's not about me. And I can be friendly and genuinely care about them, but it's not it's not the same relationship as a friend relationship. And usually that was pretty easy to navigate because in a big city you don't run into people. In a big city there's lots of groups of people that you can be friends with, and the sort of the group of people that are your patients or clients doesn't really overlap too much. However, in a smaller area like Hudson, it's been that's been interesting to navigate for me. And also, I would say maybe in a smaller town, sometimes people have very specific ideas about, for example, relationship forms and what's kind of socially acceptable or not, and also ideas about identity based on, you know, gender presentation and gender presentation of a person who may or may not be your domestic partner and things like this. So sometimes then even just to say who I live with or spend time with complicates my therapeutic relationships, if that makes sense.
You mentioned feeling disappointed moving to New York. That's kind of still resonating with me.
Yeah, so it was 1988 and I moved to New York City, and where I'd grown up, we were always like a well-rounded person that I might know among our activities might be like some awareness of, we didn't call it maybe social justice then, but you know, activism was a part of one's life. And when I first moved to Brooklyn, and I guess it was Williamsburg in 1988, it was, I felt like people certainly weren't aware of the environment. Like, I was used to recycling and kind of having a compost pile and all this stuff, and that was really fringe element at the time. No one, you know, even kind of young college-educated people that consider themselves politically liberal or progressive or leftist weren't necessarily eco-friendly at the time, you know, things like this. So I felt like it wasn't as wild and radical as I hoped, was how I was disappointed. Of course, now, you know, I look back, when I lived in Williamsburg in 1988, the waterfront was largely abandoned buildings. I liberated a number of granite paver stones to form my own garden. I mean, like, we did guerrilla gardening. There were parties, I guess you'd call them raves, in abandoned warehouses where now stand luxury apartment buildings. I remember once coming across, it was the day after some big pagan holiday. Was it May Day? I remember seeing like a giant maypole in the grass, you know, and it just, there were lots of really free of charge, you know, non-commodifiable things going on. Artists were helping each other collaborate on projects. You'd see someone filming something, doing their own film, or doing performance art, music. All these things were going on in Williamsburg in 1988. And that was pretty cool, but that had been going on where I had gone to college, so but now, of course, in comparison, that all had this kind of, oh wow, I didn't realize how good it was. I didn't, you know, I've been back to Williamsburg in maybe the last couple of years, and it's just this very strange feeling to look at the site where once it was literally open space and, you know, piles of rubble and some burned out buildings, and now it's these really slick luxury, I couldn't even go in the building. I have no reason to be there. I don't live there. I'm not staying in the hotel. And yeah, it's a strange feeling. So I guess I'm disappointed in New York again. But I still go there every week. I don't know. I love cities. Cities are made by humans, and in the best possible way, they are the best that people can do something together, right? Because there's critical mass. So a lot of people come together and make something. And so, you know, like right now, as we're recording this, we are now aware that there are all these immigrant children that have been separated from their families of origin, and it's a really, can I curse in this or no? It's really fucked up and shitty, and a lot of people, of course, it's also in a large part a continuance of policies that the prison industrial complex has lobbied for, you know, and under previous presidents, there have been a lot of incarcerations, but now it's just like, it's gone from the velvet glove has been ripped off the iron fist. And so a lot of people right now are feeling really upset and they want to do something right now. They want to do something now, which is great. Finally, maybe 10 years too late. But yes, I'm, you know, and so upstate here, right, people are trying to organize protests. And then I'm so happy to see, like, in a city like New York City or Portland, because there's more people there and people can just, there are enough people that can drop everything and go do something physical, right? So in New York and Portland, they've occupied ICE offices, they've blocked planes from landing. And so when I see things like that can happen in cities because you have enough people together to band together, to organize together, to support each other, that to me is what's great about a city.
Thanks for bringing that in.
And I guess now I'm thinking, oh, I don't want people to think I don't like that I think cities are the only place good things can happen. So I want to say some things that are unique and special to this community that I've experienced, that are still share the same goals of social justice and love for all sentient beings. So the aforementioned community garden struggle, sad and fucked up as a lot of things were about it. It was really awesome to, so another woman and I, together we were kind of people in charge of trying to organize and keep the community garden, and we compiled data in these packets to present to the council that was making the decision. And so we had a specific amount of time to speak, and in front of this council, and so we asked people to come support us, to show the community supported, because the community did support, like, why the hell would you sell this garden that poor people had founded out of literally ashes and maintained? You know, there's plenty, it's not even like Manhattan here, there's plenty of land to build things if you need more housing. Like, it seemed very mean, unnecessarily mean, and deliberately like, we can do this, so we will do this, which that was before the current presidential administration, and now I think the whole country is getting more of a taste of that, like, yeah, it doesn't make any sense, but I can do it, so I will. And so the courtroom was packed, and that was amazing, and people here in general, as compared to the city, have more, it's less frenetic. It's being gentrified, so people have to work harder than they used to just to pay their rent and their bills. But compared to the city, it's more doable to come out and show support. It's when you have an art opening, or you play your music, or you do a reading, people are more likely to show up here for each other, which is really a beautiful thing. In New York City for many years, you know, everyone's just busy, busy, busy. They've got a million things to do. And sometimes that's awesome, and then sometimes it feels almost compulsive. but also it can be really hard when you present, when you have an art opening in New York City or something like that, or a reading, because people are like, oh, I'd really love to, but my bestie is doing this, or my child, or my partner, or whatever, you know, and it's all important, and it's all great. So there's less competition for time up here. But also people are, I think, more everyday quality of life is more of a value here sometimes in the city, in terms of having leisure time, or I should say time, just more time to enjoy things. I mean, maybe it's an American disease in general to not take enough time, you know. I would just put time in, France, and it's true in Europe, and especially in France and Spain and Italy, people take more time to eat. And the experience, for example, in a restaurant is really different. And in New York City, it's kind of the extreme, where like you'll be sitting in a restaurant and they'll play really loud music so that you eat really fast, so that they can like get you to leave and then fill up another table, right? So that's on one extreme. And then in France, there's like no music, and they like, you can't even find them when you want to pay the bill, and they just let you sit there, and they don't expect you to order lots of things, and you can just take your time and talk to your friends and enjoy the food and really chew your food and not, it's like, and so I would say upstate New York is kind of in the middle of those two. We definitely, people are more likely, I think, to take their time and make time for things like hanging out with friends, enjoying some food. It's more, a little more balanced. And being a healthcare provider, that's something that I really want everyone to experience when they can. Balance. That's what we're going for.
What brought you to the healing arts?
Well, my family of origin and my own body were... There was a lot of illness in my family of origin, and I actually was myself considered a sickly child. My biological father suffered from a variety of mental and physical illnesses. Both my parents had been physically abused, mentally abused. Then my family of origin was in a really bad car accident, and I was in foster care while my parents were in the like rehab for a couple months, and I was in the hospital as a very young child for a variety of disorders. So really, I had been really immersed in kind of the medical industrial complex. And from a poor person's perspective, we were often on Medicaid or receiving food stamps. My biological father was in and out of our family. And so we were also going to clinics or medical providers that were not necessarily, how should I say? I mean, there were certainly some kindly people we encountered, but there was also a lot of really just the worst side of when medicine is a capitalist in industry. Yeah, so we were it was traumatic. There was a lot of trauma. And then when I was in college, I went to college. My mother was the first person in her family to go to university. And she started at the age of 30 as a single mom and was working and had two kids. So it was really hard. and had a disability. And so it was really important to her that I also go to university, because it was such a, at the time, also for a person of our socioeconomic class, it was like a, you know, it was really seen as a way to lift yourself out of suffering and constant exploitation. Of course, now we're looking at how student debt has been sort of sold to a lot of people who don't necessarily, can't necessarily move up in economic classes. And then I myself also have a critique about sort of that hierarchy of classes as being a desirable thing. But that's maybe another conversation. So I went to college, so that was where I was heading. I went to university and I was around people, not like people I had grown up around, a lot of middle class people. And at the time, I didn't have much class consciousness myself. So I was also a little, I had shame and I wouldn't necessarily... Well, I didn't have enough awareness either that, like, some of the things that people I was around, some of the things they had were because they had privilege. So a friend gave me a gift certificate to get a massage, and she was like, I can't believe you've never had a massage, you know, and I was, like, 16, and now that I look back at that, I'm like, what the hell? I work with people now who they're, like, 70, and they've never had a massage before, and... That's one of the reasons why I work so hard to make it accessible to folks too. But so I had this massage, and at the time I'm like 16, I had left high school a year early, because back in the 80s in the Midwest, no matter how progressive your high school was, there wasn't really awareness around bullying, and I had been really badly bullied for being gender nonconformist, and was also in a relationship with an older woman, and back then that was like, the administration's answer was, you finished your academics, you could just go to college at 16. And like, that seemed, I was like, fine, I'm hanging around with college people anyway. So I went to college, but what I'm trying to say is there was a lot of stress. And then I was in university at the age of 16, and like, I wanted to not fuck up. And so I was also self-medicating with amphetamines for a lot of reasons. Fairly recently, I realized I've had ADHD my whole life, and I've used stimulants to help me focus. And sometimes when we look at why do people use drugs, and there's a lot of judgment, like, oh. But, you know, in my case, I just want to say I was self-medicating, but a side effect, because I didn't have a healthcare provider who could, you know, guide me through the process, I had a lot of anxiety also, and I had asthma, and I had an ulcer, and I started to get panic attacks. So I got this one massage, it changed my life. I was like, also, I want to say too, my mom, you know, she was working class Catholic, and even though she was an atheist by the time she raised me, like, I think she had internalized a lot of that kind of typical Catholic body punishment murder. So my family of origin was not body positive at all on many levels. So I just, like, the idea of feeling good in your body, I had this massage, and I was really, it just helped me on so many levels, psychological, emotional, and physical. I got off my asthma medication, and I also just really started investigating, well, so there's these other things people do to, like, proactively be healthy. So that started it all. So when I went ahead and finished university with a degree in art, visual art, and moved to New York City because I didn't know what else. I just was like, well, if I'm going to get a job in art, New York seems like a good place to go. And I kind of bumbled around for a while. And I realized I didn't feel very fulfilled in many ways. So when I thought from the lens of like, oh, I'm like, I've achieved a sufficient degree of empowerment that now I feel I can choose what I want to do as my livelihood and choose to even like be trained. I realized that of all the things I'd experienced in my life, healing arts were really important to me and really interesting to me. And then specifically massage was really, had been really important to me. And then it made logical sense too, not just emotional sense, but body work is a great lens through which to focus a lot of, there's a lot of different directions you can go to. And it affects a lot of different body systems. I mean, some people, it's just very orthopedic, that's cool. And then other people experience a lot of psychological or emotional well-being from it. There are many different traditions of massage that you can weave in and study. There's world wisdom tradition systems that we can study and integrate. Always taking care not to just culturally appropriate, but really, you know, but also broaden our own way of thinking about health and healing by really immersing in a different worldview has been huge for me. And it just seems sort of infinite to keep growing in healing. And then working with people, you know, especially having been also an activist, but also, you know, working in the art world, like a lot of time we work on things and we work so hard and maybe we put everything into it and it feels like we didn't make any difference, or it's hard, you know, to know if you made a difference, or people are even unhappy with what you did. And in the healing arts, especially body work, like, first of all, I don't do any harm. It's not like a surgeon where you can slip and ruin someone's life, right? I can't ruin someone's life doing, well, not good. You know, it's like, it's a very, I definitely don't do harm, and I often have an opportunity to make a difference. And I really enjoy working with people who experience chronic pain, because to me it's such a liberatory thing. And I think that so many, I mean, everyone's suffering, all sentient beings are suffering in some way, but when some of us, it's our suffering in sort of impacts our ability to think and do things more. And I see so many people in the world who, you know, someone else might be ready to say, oh, that person's really negative, or why did they get angry, or, you know, and when you're living with pain all the time, it really limits your capacity to be present and to connect with other people. You're carrying this really heavy burden all the time, right? And so just to be able to help people manage that feels really big.
You mentioned battling Lyme disease.
Uh-huh.
How was it to move into being kind of on the other side?
Oh, it was really hard for me even to understand what was going on. And part of that is because Lyme disease, I had neurological symptoms, so I couldn't think clearly, literally. But I will also say that my own, you know, the good thing about my mom and sort of the way she is with her body is that she never gave up. Like so many people who had lived with all the things that she lived with, you know, physical, sexual abuse, all these brain tumor, car accident, trauma, mentally ill and destructive spouse. Like so many people would just give up, and she would always just pick herself up and kind of suck it up and go on. And so and that's very like working class in my family. Like, you know, my grandparents were factory workers and union organizers, and you know, it's like, okay, so the management sends people with brass knuckles over to threaten you. No, you're still gonna form the union, you know? So like there's like a nobility in that approach of like, no, we can't be beaten. But then it's also like, when do you turn that off? And so I was really sick. And then I kept on going far past the point, I think, in retrospect, I was really, really sick when I realized something was wrong, and it's funny, you know, recently also in the news, there's been some celebrity suicides, right? And so there's always these kind of well-meaning social media posts about if you're feeling, you know, reach out. And that's just bullshit. I mean, no offense, but that's, it's so complicated, you know, how to access help. And you have to be, I guess one big lesson was, like, I realized you still have to be pretty empowered to even know that it's okay to ask for help. That's like, and just looking back on all my kind of trauma and illness life, I realized, oh, that was still your, you know, like you really healed a lot from a lot of that, but that was still kind of keeping you from getting help earlier. But so then I finally, I'm probably the only person who, well, not the only person, but I realized it felt so weird to me. I had pretty much avoided Western medicine for many years and had no reason to involve myself in it. I had felt pretty good for many years, but then I started having some symptoms, which we thought were migraines. And I just, aside from the migraines for a number of years, I felt good in between. But then suddenly something shifted, and so then I was sick all the time. And so when I finally got a test that said I had Lyme disease, I was like delighted, because I realized for a number of years I had done this weird thing that happens sometimes with self-care where, and I see this now as it's getting more and more commodified too, it fits, somehow it gets, instead of being a liberatory practice, it can fit us further into this cycle of oppression. So meaning, I was like, what am I doing wrong? Like, I should be able to fix these migraines. I'm an herbalist and a massage therapist. And I was like writing down everything I did every time I got a migraine and trying to find what the trigger was so I could remove the trigger and then I wouldn't have a migraine. And then I was like, that was a fucking tick, you know, that I never saw. Or maybe I don't even know if I was bitten by a tick, you know, they don't even know actually if it's like a sexually transmitted disease now, it's a spirochete or, you know, it doesn't matter. It wasn't my fault and that I got sick, but like realizing how much I had like internalized that I should be able to do something. That was probably the freakiest part of the whole process, was like, oh, wow, how have I been living my life? Then I said, okay, I have this disease. I will, this is a useful lens. You know, sometimes we're averse to overly subscribing to diagnoses, right? With good reason, because what does that mean? It's a label, and like a label can be useful to organize with other people who maybe also feel an affinity with that label, but it can also be constraining, right? And the same with disease, sometimes it's helpful, and then other times it's you're constrained, or it's wrong, or it's not accurate, or you might get the wrong care. And anyway, in this case, I was so happy there was actually kind of, it felt easy to me, like compared to what I'd been doing. I'd been struggling so hard and feeling responsible for my pain on some level. And then I was like, oh, wow. So I have this disease and there's like pills I can even take. I was like, I hadn't taken antibiotics in like 30 years and I was so excited to take antibiotics, you know, and of course, cause I have empathy for people who like, they've been given too many of them and they've had problems with them and, you know, but here it was like, wow, this is how these things got so popular in the first place. Cause that was the start of my healing process. It wasn't the sum total. I then got just clear-headed enough to realize how sick I was. Like, basically, the antibiotics helped the neurological symptoms for a short time improve enough that I could then decide what to do next. So, mostly, I worked with a good friend of mine and colleague who's a Chinese medicine practitioner. And then I I took a lot of herbs and I did some other stuff, and my friend and colleague was just about the right mix of both caring for me but also working with me as a colleague too. And then also, just because I'm a kind of a science geek, I feel like I'm a guinea pig too, and that can contribute both to the knowledge that whenever I get sick or, you know, an injury, for me it's also great information to inform my own healing practice. So that was also maybe helpful to make it more, make the process of healing less depressing, and also like I felt like I had more of an active hand in it for that reason too. And it was mostly, though, it was a pretty slow slog for about a year and a half. I was still, I was definitely getting better, but still felt pretty shitty for the first year. And then the second year, markedly feeling better. But, you know, I didn't really feel like myself for 3 years. And I couldn't write. Like, I wrote, I published my first novel in 2011, and then I didn't write anything between 2013 and 2016, because I just couldn't think straight and didn't, yeah. So that was a big deal when I started writing again. That's when I felt myself again, I would say. And then physically I'm still not completely cured, though. I still am taking herbs and I still have some minor symptoms that I'm managing. But overall, it's been quite a journey. And then last year, I decided I was well enough that I could start the other big thing about the illness was really having to prune a lot of things I like to do for my schedule just to make enough time to rest. And that is a really tricky thing. And it also really has taught me a lot about how I advise my own patients, because I realized like it can really feel like punishment. Like sometimes when someone tells you, oh, you should rest, and it's like, well, resting means not writing. Resting means not reading a book. Resting means not traveling to Nepal. Resting means, you know, it's also a lot of, so navigating that was pretty tricky too. So last year I started very slowly to organize with a couple other people towards, who also have experienced Lyme and tick-borne disease. And so we hope to make a project that's part oral history, perhaps, part archive of resources, and part peer counseling around tick-borne disease in the Hudson Valley area. And so that, I feel like I have more agency over my experience now. But for a while there, well, you really are colonized for a while. And I mean, we're with the biome and our gut bacteria, and we are really ecosystems. We're not individuals. And my first novel, I write about that a lot, actually. And that's very interesting to me. But in the depths of my Lyme disease, I wasn't myself. I was more the organism. And when you have neurological symptoms where you're thinking thoughts you wouldn't normally think, it's a really strange thing.
I wonder, based on your experiences, maybe around Lyme disease, but also your life experiences, if there's been particular challenges or disidentifications with the kind of the healing arts, or like what people think of as the healing arts.
Yeah. Yeah, and massage therapists in particular are often the butt of jokes. A lot of people don't even realize that I have a medical license that I went to school for and took a test and joyfully, I will add, take continuing education credits to maintain, like a nurse or any other kind of medical license. Sometimes people use terminology like masseuse or things that I find, well, I try not to react with offense and I try to educate, but it's, there's a lot of kind of, I think there was a TV show called Friends. I think it's in reruns now. I have never owned a TV, so TV is like a whole weird thing to me. But people would often tell me, oh, I guess there was a character. I've seen the show now, and there was, I don't enjoy the show. I don't enjoy TV, but I especially didn't enjoy the show. And it, I mean, TV is so weird. It's like, it's, does anyone think it's remotely realistic? I don't know. It was a show about a group of young people living in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, right? And there's this, and I had never met anyone like these people. And certainly not like this massage therapist who was not very intelligent and was kind of the butt of a lot of jokes. And so sometimes people would, I don't know, talk to me about an episode of Friends that they'd seen where the massage therapist did something. And I just was on so many levels really at a loss to respond. And so pop culture representation of massage therapists, I don't know where they come from. I remember my first business in Brooklyn. We had there weren't any massage therapy only studios in Brooklyn at the time. And so the local paper wrote about us. I was in private practice with a friend of mine, and they wanted to take a picture, and the photographer wanted me to like put these stones in a row on someone's back, which is like this stock photo that I've seen a million times. And you never do that. It feels horrible to have hot stones lying on your back in a line. That's not how we use them therapeutically. We like rub them on the person. Anyway, so I don't know how I got off on this tangent. So there's that. So like people have a lot of ideas. Oh, and then I guess there's this whole confusion between sex workers and licensed massage therapists. And it's really maybe doubly hard for me because I really, I've had friends who have been sex workers, and I really want sex workers to be safe and be protected and for there not to be shame around that. And I want everyone to be able to talk about their needs, and I think it's a valid therapy in and of itself, and I would like people to be able to access it, and I would like the people who perform that service to also be safe and be able to not be exploited. And I also don't do that myself. So, when someone mistakenly, because our culture conflates them, sometimes people do contact me and they're really looking for, sexual services. I really agonize over how to respond to them so that I don't, perpetuate all of the kind of shame and weirdness in our society, but I also need to protect myself. And, so there's that too. It doesn't happen that often, actually. It's only happened really upstate people. I don't know, maybe they find my number on the internet and they just see the word massage and presume all massage is sexual. So there's all of that. And a lot of people, even maybe like people I went to art school with and people in my family also think sometimes that being a massage therapist is something for people who aren't very smart, which is interesting to me that, to me, there's so much to learn and know about the body and so many different kinds of experiences that can be brought into it, and there's so many sort of intellectual conceptualizing that can be done about all of it. But I guess maybe that's part of our lack of body positivism in our culture, like that there's even a separation. I think people, it's kind of like some people think maybe dancers or athletes also must be, you know, not as smart because you do this thing with your body as if your body was separate from your mind. So maybe that's where that comes from.
And in terms of, I mean, I'm thinking specifically of Hudson and how people who are outside of the world of healing arts might see it from the outside
Oh,
in terms of
yeah.
just like who is, what kind of clients would come, or like.
Right, right. Well, up here, I've. So the class thing has come up again because, like my own self, like a lot of people, their family of origin doesn't experience massage, or they think massage is for fancy people, or that it's a luxury, or that it's only in spas, or it's only for women, or it's only, they have all these ideas about that. So the Hudson Wellness Collective and other little clinics I've done, I always really try to make demystify massage. I've also practiced massage in Ireland, in Europe, where public health insurance pays for massage, the way that physical therapy here is compensated for by insurance. And I often try to educate people about that. A lot of times it's really helping people come to a place where they can give themselves permission to get a massage, because they have a lot of, they feel it's like something that's a treat rather than a legitimate therapy, as people might call it. So there's that. Then there's, people might assume things about my personality, or they might look at the way I appear. Well, I had someone once, I've had a couple people remark that maybe they have ideas that a massage therapist should look and act like a really gentle person. And maybe I do sometimes give gentle massages. I have a very gentle touch, if that's what's called for. We have a broad palette of type of touch, but I would say my physical appearance is, I don't know, some people, well, when that thing came out on social media where people talked about resting bitchy face, I was like, yes, that's me. Because I look serious, I guess, is maybe a way. Sometimes I look serious. And so, well, here's something that came up a couple of times I've been at the gym at Planet Fitness, working out, minding my own business, and then later someone will say, wow, I saw you at the gym, but I didn't say hi because you looked really intense, you know, and I don't know what that was about. So yeah, so there's like a physical image thing that I guess I don't fit the appearance some people think is appropriate for a massage therapist. I remember once I was with a friend who's an acupuncturist, and she was really stressed out. She really wanted a cigarette. She had stopped smoking and just really wanted a cigarette. And so I was with her, and one of her patients actually berated her because he felt that a healthcare provider should not be, you know, should always 24/7 be modeling the epitome of health, right, for a healthcare provider. So, I guess people have expectations about our public presentation. Yeah. And then being an artist too, you know, there's people are like confused about that sometimes, and other artists are confused about it. And what can I say? I'm not confused about it. So there's that.
I want to give you a moment just to think about if there's anything else you want to bring in to put on record.
I don't know. The thing that's coming up for me, this is kind of funny. I was on the New York City subway a couple months ago, and there's a program for poetry. They print poems on the like in the advertising space. And there was sometimes there's poems that I think are nice, and other times poems I'm not so interested in. But there was this one poem that made me really angry because it was a poem about someone trying to sit at their desk and write a poem, and they had writer's block. And it just felt really like, really, okay, maybe that's fine to write a poem about that, but why would they choose that? I just think about all these people in the subway, and there's this limited space, and it's a privilege to have your voice heard, you know, and there's a lot of people whose voices are never heard. So I guess I just wanted to say that because I'm really aware that I'm being recorded and I don't even know who's going to be listening to this, but, you know, I just want to acknowledge that when we hear stories, it doesn't mean that that person's story is more important than your story or anyone else's story. And I just want you to know that I'm aware. I don't think I'm like so special that I just want to honor that there are so many stories out there, and I hope everyone who wants to tell their story or tell a story can be heard. And thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah. Thank you for offering your story to be added to many more.